Thank you very much, Miss Pezzula. That's just about the nicest introduction I've ever had. And Father Campbell, Father Clark, Father Reese, Mr. Dale, my friend Jim O'Brien, and all of the participants here today in the National Catholic Social Action Conference. Yeah, I do feel at home at Georgetown because I have a special relationship to this great university. I'm its only honorary student. Many people receive honorary degrees, but it is a rare honor to be an honorary student. And to have had that honor bestowed upon me here at Georgetown is one that I cherish. Dr. Theobald, I want to express my thanks to you for your graciousness and kindness this morning. This is your morning, really, and I sort of crowded in on you, but I think you'll understand why I did this. Tonight, I must be present for a wedding rehearsal, and I'm just the father of the groom, and of course, you really don't have to do much in that position, but you at least have to get into the church on time. And tomorrow at 10 o'clock, my son Robert will marry a very lovely young lady, Miss Donna Erickson, at St. Olaf Catholic Church in Minneapolis, Minnesota. So I just insisted that I get on the program early. In fact, Mrs. Humphrey insisted if I was going to be on the program at all. She insisted if I was to be on this program at all that I do it now, get on that airplane and get home, which is what I hope to be able to do. You have an exciting program, and I have given great thought to what I might say here today that would be of some interest to you and possibly of some help. Not as a matter of giving you the truth, because you'll find that and search for it yourself, but to offer some observations that may be worthy of your consideration and of your discussion. It is a real privilege for me to address this 10th annual convention of the National Catholic Action Social Action Conference. And I can say once again that your challenging program reaffirms what some of us have known for a long, long time. Namely, that you are operating at the cutting edge of the critical social issues of our time. One of the most heartening developments in recent history has been the growing realization among men of all religions and all faiths that the tenets of their faiths necessarily lead them to confront and to combat human suffering, social misery, and injustice wherever they are found. The National Catholic Social Action Conference has been providing, in its most literal sense, a basis for dialogue between the church and the world, as recommended by the Vatican Council. It's making religion come alive. Now, these are trying days for all people whose cause is social justice and human dignity. We're told that rioting and violence in our urban areas threaten our achievements of the past and indeed the hope of progress in the future. We are told that the national consensus, which recently seemed so much in favor of equal rights and opportunity for all, has been weakened and is being replaced by a growing antagonism amongst peoples, as well as a growing antagonism to progress in civil rights. We are told that our democratic system has not been dealing effectively with the urgent human needs which exist in our inner cities and in our rural areas. And we're told that the civil rights movement itself is rent and torn by factionalism, antagonisms, and personal rivalries, that the unity which had been its hallmark and a source of its strength is slipping away. Yes, we're told all of these things, and we're told them daily by word and event. And as a result, some people believe that our march towards human freedom and human rights has been halted. And some even seeing us falling back in retreat. Are the victories of 1964 and 65, I refer to the legislative victories, and the successes in all parts of America, are these to be our stopping point? We go no further? Are the remaining problems, we can ask ourselves, too big, too complex to be solved? Now, there is enough truth in some of these reports and some of these concerns to cause deep concern among us. But I know of no person who truly believes in the dignity of all men or who truly understands the relationship between freedom for Negro Americans and other minorities and freedom for every American who doubts for a moment the eventual outcome of this struggle. This confidence we must have. And believing as I do and confident as I am, there is nevertheless a need for setting forth with greater clarity and vision why we are now experiencing these apparent setbacks when victory seemed so near, so close at hand only a year ago. It is time to examine more carefully the problems which clearly exist, but to do so in relation to the undeniable progress which has been and is still being made. It is, for example, time to face the fact that the struggle for human rights and equal opportunity is confronted with a crisis of confidence among many citizens of our land. We hear many questions asked. In all honesty, such as, given the many legislative and administrative victories for civil rights, why are we still confronted with such complex or unresolved issues? In fact, some people say we've done so much, why do they ask for more? Have we made progress at all during lasting solutions? And then where do we go from here? Well, now I wouldn't presume to be able to answer all of these questions today, even among good friends that would be tolerant of my answers. But I do wish to offer, as I said in the beginning, several observations about why our present state of affairs has arisen and what this perhaps means to Christians committed to translating their faith into action in ways that are relevant to the social issues of our time. We must remember that we are participants, we in this very room, in a worldwide surge throughout humanity. People in many walks of life realize that the attainment of human values is crucial to their survival as individuals and indeed to the maintenance of social order. By human values, I mean such qualities, just to mention one or two, as self-respect and self-confidence. And coupled with a sense of respect for the accomplishment of others. I mean the realization of a sense of identity among individuals and groups, an understanding of one's role in life and one's value to society, and how difficult it is in this great mass of everything that we have today to find one's identity, to find oneself, to know that you are an individual with a heart and a soul and a spirit and a personality. I mean the commitment to self-sacrifice, the willingness to labor for the common good, even if it entails personal hardship and danger. We must, of course, concern ourselves with the physical needs of life. This we know. And that is why your government, this administration, is to the limit of its resources, waging this battle on a scale never before achieved. In this regard, you might be interested in knowing, since it's so much in the headlines these days, that total federal assistance to cities, and this doesn't include some of the alleged fringe benefits, will increase by almost $2.5 billion from fiscal years 1965 through 1967. Maybe that is not enough, but it is substantial. Federal assistance to rural to urban areas will in fact rise much faster than both total federal aid and total federal spending. But I want to be quite clear about it. We understand that even this is not enough. We know that we must do more, but it is also important that we understand how much is being done right now. And I might add how much better we could do even with what we have if we but bend ourselves to the task. We also know that a truly humanized life consists more than merely possessing adequate food and shelter. The rehabilitation that we need in America's cities is not merely the rehabilitation of the physical structure, but indeed of men and women themselves, of people. We know it involves primarily the chance to use the unique spiritual qualities which man alone possesses, the ability to create, to judge, to exercise freedom, freedom of choice, and to accept responsibility, and to acquire dignity and self-respect. In the terrible rioting and violence which have gripped our cities, we can often discover twisted and mistaken attempts to achieve a sense of identity by persons who blindly retaliate against a society that has seemingly denied them all chance to achieve their humanity in acceptable ways. Now, we cannot condone or excuse this violence. It does not accomplish a constructive purpose. We cannot condone it, whatever the cause. Nor can we overlook the role of some hoodlums and agitators in certain of the disorders. And we cannot condone rioting, civil disorder, looting, or burning. It just doesn't fit into the pattern of the redress of grievances which our society provides. But we can, and we must learn from these outbreaks that a major factor in our remaining problems of human rights is the vicious interlocking system of the ghetto, which mercilessly strips all vestiges of humanity from its victims. And we can and we must learn that lasting solutions will have to involve the chance for people who live there to become real persons, persons of self-identity and self-respect in their own eyes and in the eyes of society. And this is achieved when there exists the opportunity to hold a meaningful and rewarding job, to live in a decent and comfortable home, and to accept the challenge of raising a family, to participate in the governing of a neighborhood or of a city or of a nation. Yes, this involves the freedom to exercise meaningful choice in the vital areas of life, and then the willingness to accept responsibility for those decisions. As President Johnson said last week, in the law courts, in the city jails, in the city halls, in the school boards, in Congress, in the White House, men are constantly trying to balance one man's rights fairly with another's. And this entire work of balancing, of seeking justice between men, rests on the acceptance of responsibility among men. This is the whole process of free government, how we can balance off the rights of one with another without destroying the rights of anyone else. This involves casting aside forever the clever and sophisticated techniques which sought and usually produced deadened and dependent, yes, dehumanized persons. And we must not underestimate the historical significance of all of these developments. Seldom, if ever, has a nation embarked on such a revolutionary course or mounted such a massive program of conscious self-examination and self-improvement. We can almost feel a sense of pardonable pride in our country today, with all of its problems, that at least we are taking a look at ourselves and we're trying to find some answers to our inadequacies. We must also understand that this revolution, and it is a revolution that is underway, peaceful and nonviolent as it has largely been, must also produce instances of acute frustration and despair as expectations outstrip reality and performance falls short of promises. My fellow Americans, we have some underdeveloped areas too. And there is this thing we call rising expectations. And with it comes turbulence. And with it, at times, comes uncertainty and disorder. To expect that such a momentous effort as we have launched could go forward without friction or controversy and occasional setbacks is to underestimate the barriers to social progress which exist in any society and in our own, even one as relatively free and democratic as ours. But the progress, nevertheless, is here, and it is real. We are moving, and we are moving forward. I remember when the late President Kennedy said, "Let's get this country moving again." Not just economically, but moving in terms of its conscience, its sense of what is right and what is wrong. And we have been moving, and we desperately need the support and the involvement of persons like yourselves in this, if this progress is to be sustained over the long, difficult months and years ahead. It is interesting to note the similar emphasis on the dignity of the human person in the historic encyclicals of Pope John the 23rd and Pope Paul the 6th, not to mention the documents of the Vatican Council. Let me quote just one sentence from the text of the Church in the Modern World. There is a growing awareness of the exalted dignity proper to the human person. Therefore, there must be made available to all men everything necessary for leading a life truly human. That's why we're here this morning. That's what this conference is about, to find how we can add genuine meaning and application of meaning to that profound observation. Yes, we seek the right for all men, all mankind, to lead a life truly human. And we know this involves both worldly and spiritual pursuits. The Vatican Council also stressed the importance of increasing the involvement and the activity of the laity in these social issues and crises. The theme is sounded in many of the Council's documents, and these pronouncements reaffirm vigorously what had already become evident in recent years as the Church grappled with the complex forces which help shape human lives and determine human history. I remember vividly the impact which churchmen of all faiths made in bringing into sharp focus the moral imperatives which confronted the Congress during the civil rights debate in the spring and the summer of 1964. I met with these leaders time after time. I have said from many platforms, and I'd repeat it once again today, we could never have enacted this legislation without the dedicated laborers of the Catholic, Protestant, and Jewish spiritual leaders. It would have been impossible. But they went to work. They brought to bear conscience upon Congress. Today, the challenge we face is even more urgent than in 1964. Not only on Capitol Hill, where a difficult struggle awaits in the Senate, but also in the streets and the alleys of our urban ghettos and in the roads and the fields of our rural slums. For it is one thing to enact legislation which outlaws flagrant examples of racial discrimination, such as segregated hotels, buses, and parks. But it is another thing to eliminate the more subtle, sophisticated techniques which have effectively limited true freedom of choice in jobs and education and housing for decades. It is one thing, my fellow Americans, to cry freedom now or on a picket line, but it is another thing to achieve true freedom in the squalid world of the ghetto, where generations of exploitation have produced problems which no man and no government can overcome in a day, a week, or a year. where we see and feel the devastating impact of the tragic equation, which has too often decreed that the poor shall beget poor, that ignorance shall beget misery. It is one thing to demand the federal government meet its growing responsibilities in civil rights. And I can say as an officer in that federal government that it will. But it is another thing to generate in our states and in our localities, in our communities, the commitment and the urgency required to produce significant improvement in the lives of people where they live, right in their communities. Let me add, you cannot build a beautiful city out of Washington. You can make Washington, D.C. a beautiful city, but every person has to be responsible for the city beautiful where you live. And it requires individual involvement in your city, because it is there where you'll either have poor schools or good schools, good housing or inadequate housing, slums or a city that is fit for human existence. Right back home. This is a job which must be done, and you are the people who must help do it. You must at least be the catalyst, the catalytic agent that inspires people or provokes people into action. Now, I've spoken here today of the crisis we face here at home and of our responsibility in meeting it. But you and I know that this responsibility does not stop at the water's edge. Yesterday morning, I went to Atlantic City to address the National Convention of the Jewish War Veterans. And I spoke to them on responsibility. And I mentioned that there isn't any such thing as a foreign policy and a domestic policy. Those days, if ever they were true, are long past. It is one and inseparable, possibly the most significant foreign policy act, if you wish to call it that, was the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It had a tremendous impact. But everything we do here at home affects what we try to do abroad. What makes you think that we can lead a world in its war on hunger and poverty if we can't even win it here with the resources that we have at our command? It's how we live here. It's what we do here. It's the success that we have here that will prove the credibility of our case abroad, that will inspire others to do for themselves what they ought to do, and will make our effort look meaningful. In an age where science and technology have shrunk our physical neighborhood, no crisis is wholly foreign to us. No curse or blessing is received in isolation. Today, responsibility for our fellow man in other parts of the world is inescapable. All of you, everyone assembled here today, are well aware of the challenge to the Christian conscience posed by the growing disparity between rich nations and poor, the widening gap between the affluent minority and the impoverished masses of the human race. Our obligation here was spelled out in bold language by Pope John the 23rd in his encyclical Mater et Magistra. You remember his words. By the way, that's some mighty good reading for everybody. I put those encyclicals in the Congressional Record at the time. I thought Congress could use a few moments of their time reading those encyclicals. Pope John the 23rd said in that encyclical, "The solidarity which binds all men and makes them members of the same family requires political communities enjoying an abundance in material goods, not to remain indifferent to those political communities whose citizens suffer from poverty, misery, and hunger, and who lack even the elementary rights of the human person. This is particularly true since, given the growing interdependence among the peoples of the earth, It is not possible to preserve lasting peace if glaring economic and social inequality among them persist. End of quote. That's the lesson for the day. That's what we're here about. And this is the lesson that every statesman, every diplomat, every businessman, every labor leader, every teacher, every mother and father, every child needs to understand in America above all. We are an affluent minority in a world of the poor. And that affluence can be taken away from us unless we learn how to share, and in so doing not lose what we have, but in a very, very real sense, gain more and protect that which is ours. This concern for assisting the less fortunate peoples of the world in achieving dignity and self-respect has been reaffirmed by Pope Paul in his eloquent plea at the United Nations last year. It was recognized by the Vatican Council, which called upon the entire Christian community to give special attention to the problem of world poverty, and I might add world hunger, because God's children face the specter of famine unless we bend ourselves to the effort of bringing fruit from the good earth. It was the central preoccupation of the men and women who met in Geneva last month for the Church and World Order Conference of the World Council of Churches. Responding to the Vatican Council's recommendation, the Catholic Church is now moving to establish institutions whose primary responsibility will be to educate the Christian conscience on the problem of social justice. I understand that a report has been prepared for the Pope, and the establishment of a permanent secretariat on world justice is under consideration. These new initiatives are good news, which have been developed in close cooperation with the World Council of Churches, are of great importance to all men concerned with the pursuit of human dignity. We are then, both here and abroad, as I said a moment ago, participants in a worldwide surge throughout humanity, a surge for a better life, with people long denied, but who today have glimpsed the dimensions of what such a life entails: liberty and freedom, responsibility and dignity and justice. And who can doubt the ultimate outcome of this struggle? If we become discouraged, and I imagine on occasion one does, or are tempted to abandon the fight for human dignity and social justice, and some have, let us only recall the teachings of Pope John the 23rd as set forth in Pacem in Terris. Beautiful words, but a moving thought, indeed a command. Every believer, said Pope John in Pacem in Terris, every believer in this world of ours must be a spark of light, a center of love, a vivifying leaven among his fellow men. In fact, there can be no peace between men unless there is peace within each one of them. Unless, that is, each one builds up within himself the order wished by God. Now, my friends, you have gathered here this morning and in this conference to carry forward the urgent task of building peace among men and peace within men, because only then can there be peace. I submit that there is no more urgent, no more vital, no more sacred task than this task of peace among men and peace within men. I'm happy that I've had the chance this morning to share these observations with you, and I wish you well in your deliberations, and I commend every participant in this conference for bringing your message to the nation's capital, because it is here where we need to hear it so clearly, and you can have a great effect, a tremendous impact upon the decisions of government, as well as the commitments of individuals. Thank you. Thank you.